Had a jelly bean, though. Well,
all right.
The voters should vote yes on Prop 9.
Well, I wish the voters, before they make up their minds on Proposition 9, would look at exactly what it would do and look at the legislation that we now have before the legislature. I believe that we have presented a more effective plan. I'm concerned about some facets of Prop 9. I'm also concerned with the fact that two of the things already passed by the legislature would be weakened by Proposition 9. What?
You're against it?
Well, I was just being critical of portions of it here, but I believe that the legislation, I think the legislation that has been presented would do a more effective job of reform than Prop 9. Well, there, in the areas of disclosure and, as I understand, the conflict of interest, it just isn't as effective as what has already been adopted. They're in the Legislative Council now. Getting all the eyes.
Yeah, but that is definitely one of the bills going in.
Well, I can't answer for the Legislative Council. There's certain things that have to be done. That's the legislative process up there before they can then go out to the legislature, and he has them for make sure that all the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted and so forth, and now it's in their mill, not mine.
There are difficulties with Senate Republicans are resolved now, and your appointees are going to go through. You had conversations about that?
I never thought that I had any difficulties with the Senate Republicans.
They seem to be.
So far, we've gotten along just fine. A great many not only Republicans, but Democrats. I know what you're referring to. Over these weeks, have come to me with endorsements and high recommendations for their colleague, Senator Marler, and they found no disagreement as far as I'm concerned. I think as highly of them as they do. And I think that they're pretty uniformly pleased at what has happened.
Governor, Mayor Alioto says he feels what he terms a concerted drive by state, local, and federal officials is necessary to make sure there are not more zebra suspects at large elsewhere in the state. But the state attorney general says his office is merely conducting a coordinating, supportive role. Do you feel there should be a much more intensive state investigation on this?
Well, I think the attorney general is doing all that needs to be done from the state line, and I think there is complete coordination. As a matter of fact, the mayor himself has stated that he is in touch and is seeking and taking advice from the attorney general. And I think there is a full investigation going forward.
Shouldn't the state be taking the lead in this, though, rather than simply waiting for local agencies to take the lead?
Well, I don't think that we're waiting for anyone. I think the state investigative procedure is going forward.
Do you know of any evidence at all that there is a connection between the murders in San Francisco and others that are supposed to have taken place around?
No, I do not. And I don't know that anyone actually has evidence to that effect. I think this is one of the areas that is being investigated.
Repeated indications that allegedly police agencies knew anywhere from 3 to 7 months ago the alleged existence of a statewide or nationwide conspiracy in this case.
Well, as a matter of fact, when you say an alleged conspiracy, not only the police agencies knew it, the public knew it. There was a story carried in the news several months ago that there were reports, and it did not say whether confirmed or whether there was evidence to substantiate them, but that there were reports that this was a cult type of thing in which the killing was a part of an initiation. And then since that time, there has been very little mentioned about that.
You don't think it would have been appropriate for law enforcement officers to move in or in any way control the groups at that point?
Well, I don't know what law enforcement was doing at that point. From then on, I have to assume that if they had such a report, that they must have been checking it out.
There perhaps be some sort of legislative investigation?
legislature could has the facilities to come up with this kind of criminal study or investigation.
Have you had an opportunity to read any of the transcripts that the president has transmitted to the House committee?
Only those that have appeared in the papers. I have made a request for the full transcript.
Your reaction to how did they strike you? Did they strike you the way the president hopes it will strike the people?
Well, I have to say that I was struck by the what appears to be a difference between now some of the interpretations of those and the verbatim transcript, the first verbatim section that was printed and read verbatim. I noticed that some commentators have left out mention of things that were in that, and I think that I would hope that everyone would try. I know 1,200 pages is that's a lot of reading, and yet I don't think anyone can make any judgments until they have read the entire 1,200 pages, the verbatim transcript, and not the interpretations of them.
What's your personal reaction? Are you surprised by anything that you wrote?
No, I was quite conscious of and aware of one thing in that first transcript that seems to have been ignored, as I say, a great deal by those who are interpreting it now, and that was the flat statement by Dean to the president when he said, "Mr. President, I know from our conversation that you are not aware of these things."
March 21st.
Yes.
Subject? You say you have high regard for Senator Marler. Why were you not willing to appoint him to the appellate bench? What were your reasons for not appointing him?
Well, I don't think that I should go into the reasons of why someone is appointed judge or someone is not appointed a judge. We follow the same process that we followed on all the appointments so far. And it's a screening process, and it's an attempt to get those that come to us with the ratings of all the various groups that we go through in the screening. And we settled upon two fine Superior Court judges, trial judges here in Sacramento, and this, of course, does have a bearing. While we have appointed to the appellate court, sometimes directly from the field of law and not from the trial court, the overwhelming majority that I have appointed have been from the trial court.
I think that local persons in the bar here in Sacramento, for some reason, didn't choose to find Senator Marler acceptable?
No, I'm not saying that at all. We've used the same process, and as I've said, I think that Senator Marler is highly qualified, or he wouldn't have been considered in the first place. And I think he'll make a fine judge.
In that connection, the Commission on Judicial Appointments apparently has yet to act on your nomination of John Cassin. Are they leaving him to twist in the wind? It's been weeks.
I don't know. I know that this is in the process, and that's all I know.
Governor, another subject.
Well, wait a minute.
Well, I am in total disagreement with the state bar, and I understand that the state bar's vote on whether to even involve itself, which is a highly unusual thing for them to do, was 8-7, which hardly sounds like a great uprising of the legal profession. And as I say, I am in disagreement with them. I have known John Bocassin for more than 10 years, served closely with him now, and had him here where great opportunity to view him, and I think he is excellently qualified.
Do you think it's improper for the state bar, they started a policy with that appointment, to rate the appellate court your nomination to governor?
Well, all I can say is it was an unusual thing for them to do, and I'm quite curious myself to know this.
On the Marler appointment, you said yesterday that in appointing Senator Marler to the Superior Court, you followed the same procedures.
That's right.
That you usually follow. Now, did you, in fact, submit that nomination to the local bar and to your local screening committee?
To all of the committees, except in this instance, because technically his residence is in the county in which he is elected, I screened there with the bar that was associated with him there and knew him as a lawyer in that area. Now, true, he is being appointed to a bench here in Sacramento. But he has, to all intents and purposes, physically been a resident of this area and intended when he left the Senate to make Sacramento his home. But in our process, the bar that would be queried about him would be the his peers in his area where he was a lawyer, among lawyers. Other than that, well, it was the same process, the regular process. There was the difference here that he is being appointed living in, technically in one county and appointed to the bench in this county. So we didn't check with this bar locally here. We checked with the local bar in his home.
You criticized Governor Brown for making political appointments to the courts. Isn't this a political appointment?
No. I think the only way that you could say this is a political appointment is the fact that the man holds a public office to which he was elected. But let me again state something, and I will challenge anyone, and you can make reference to the bar or anyone in the legal profession in the state of California. I am the first governor, to my knowledge, who has ever voluntarily given up his right to personally choose judges and have submitted all applicants to a process in which we get the rating of the bar from the state bar board to the to their peers in their own area and to a layman and the judiciary. And this has been well known in the legal profession, and many comments have been made about this process. We have never made an exception to it in all of these some 600 appointments that I have made so far. I hope, I promise, 66 that I would take the appointment of judges out of politics. I have done that.
Speculation for months that because Senator Marler lost his seat, he would therefore be appointed to a judgeship.
Well, speculation, it comes from the very fact that Senator Marler, like many other people, aspired to the bench. He looked to this as eventually a career that he wanted. And obviously his friends knew this. So they kept talking. I think he's the second legislator that has been appointed to the bench. But when I meant the taking of judgeships out of politics, I have said this publicly before, and you might as well know it, that if I did not have the system that we've had, and if I had not followed this totally, there have been a number of instances in which I could have been more successful in things that I was trying to do if I had been willing to appoint judges on another basis. Well, if it did, someone was awfully suspicious, because all you have to do is to talk to his colleagues and talk to all the people in the legal profession and fellow judges, and you will find that he is held in the highest esteem.
Governor, on that same topic, you have called for a law to prohibit campaign contributions by judges, but the check of your 1970 campaign report indicates that you yourself, your campaign, accepted contributions from several judges.
Well, that's right, and the first I knew about it was when I heard this, because I didn't pay any attention to who was contributing or who wasn't in my campaign. But I think the difference and what has brought this about now is the feeling on the part of people that there is a need for a review of the whole campaign procedures. I do think that there is a difference between an individual judge making a contribution and the incident that brought this into prominence or into the spotlight of a judge having a fund which he administered and made contributions from, but which was collected from other people. And there's no way to block such a thing without just making the blanket rule. And therefore, in our campaign reforms, we propose the blanket rule, even though it does infringe on the individual rights of a judge.
Can the law just prohibit funds but permit individual giving, if that's how you really feel about it?
Well, maybe in the legislative process, someone will discuss that and see whether that would meet the problem.
Do you believe that the jurists who made contributions should be investigated, for example, by the Commission on Judicial Qualifications, or do you think that your legislation should be a starting point so that persons are put on notice in the future that this type of thing is clearly improper?
Well, the judiciary has its own methods of policing its profession, and whatever they feel should be done with regard to any case, that's up to them. But as far as I am concerned, this is the starting point.
In 1971, when it was disclosed you paid no state income tax, you said the reason for this was business reverses. You were asked the same question 2 weeks ago at Davis, and this is the answer you gave, and I quote, "There was 1 year out of my entire adult life in which I had no state tax obligation, income tax obligation. I did not have any tax shelters. I did not have any gimmicks or devices. Now some of the legitimate deductions which accounted for my not having a tax obligation were property taxes on property tax I held that amounted to almost half of my total salary as governor. Now those are legitimate deductions." How can you shift your explanation to this question?
Well, that isn't really, no, that isn't a shift of the explanation. The explanation is still true. If I mentioned those because there had been, as you know, other questions that were being asked about so-called loopholes, and I had been discussing the subject, of what constitutes a loophole, interest on mortgages and so forth,
did
and how they're legitimate.
Reverse?
What?
Why didn't you give the answer of business reversal that you gave us in 71?
Well, if you take the figures that I gave just there, I used an example of other taxes that I paid, which were deductible.
Anything about property taxes in 1971, you said business reversal.
Oh, no. I told you in 1971 that in three things alone accounted for the for a greater share or portion of my salary as governor. And it was that, charitable contributions, and medical expenses, all three of which are legitimate deductions. But the other story is true. What I was saying about no tax gimmicks, and I said in 1971 also, because a number of you seemed to speculate that because I still owned some cattle that that was a tax shelter. And if you will remember, some of you went far afield in writing about that. Now, the truth of the matter was part of my income came from the few cattle that I owned. They were a plus, not a minus. So that could hardly be construed a tax shelter. What I'm saying is that the conversation and the talk that everyone who takes deductions must have some kind of fancy shelter over here that involves some kind of finagling to avoid taxes, I had nothing of that kind. I had straight deductions of losses, of expenses such as other taxes and so forth, that brought me to the point where I had no tax obligation because I had no income over and above that, taxable income above that. There's a great difference between saying I was involved in, let's say, some kind of investment that was designed to get me out of paying taxes, and therefore I eliminated my tax burden. I didn't have anything of that kind. I still am. What?
Has there been any change in your status of your land down there?
No. Nope.
Mm-hmm.
I
would have spoken to him 2 days ago. I believe that he could make 100,000 arrests for speeders a day if he had the people to do it. With this 55 mile per hour speed limit, do we have a situation sort of like prohibition with people just, it being a law that people simply aren't going to obey? And if so, have you given any thought to maybe raising the speed limit?
Well, there's a very funny thing about this and this assumption that everyone is simply violating it. First of all, 55 miles an hour in all of the polls seems to have become very popular with the people. Matter of fact, one of the Democratic assemblymen upstairs has found out that about three-fourths of his constituents, in answer to a newsletter, now favor 55 miles an hour, and not just to save gas. I think where there is, first of all, I think we're in a little dangerous period of laxity right now, where the people have decided because they're getting gas and they're not lined up at the gas stations that the crisis is over, and it is not. And it'll be right back again if people do relax. And that goes for not only driving automobiles, but it goes for turning on lights and turning up the thermostat or the coolers or whatever they do. We still are in a period of energy shortage. And I think psychologically, the worst thing in the world would be to suggest to people that they can start going fast. What we have discussed, and it would require legislation, is that when we can for certainty say that we do not need the gas shortage or the gas savings that we're getting from the lower speed limit, that we should very seriously discuss maintaining the 55 speed limit in the urban areas, on the freeways within the urban areas, but then recognize the problem of those people that have got 400 miles to go out there on a less heavily traveled freeway like 5 up through the valley, and go back to having an in-town and an out-of-town speed limit. This, I think, could make a great deal of sense because we learned something else in our urban freeways. We have learned that the average travel time at 55 is better, if anything, than the average travel time when you were allowed to go 70. That the stop and go from 70 to traffic jam ups in the freeways has been eliminated, and at 55 we have a steady flow of traffic in the urban freeway areas. And we've learned this, and it's very possible that we, when we can relax, because it's no longer a need to save gasoline, that we may find that we want to maintain that within the cities, and it'll even be more efficient.
Cars are going through the L.A. metropolitan area heading for Sacramento. How would you know whether it should be going 55 or 65 miles an hour?
Oh, no, just the same as if there wasn't a freeway. Now, you know, when you drove up on the regular highways and they went through the towns instead of around them, and before freeways started going around them, when you came to a town, there was a sign that said the speed limit is, and you slowed down to that, and when you got to the other side of town, there was a sign that said resume speed or speed limit now 65 or whatever it was. Well, the same thing would apply to the freeways. As you reached a certain point, say you were taking the San Diego freeway through Los Angeles, you'd reach a point and there'd be a sign that now said the speed limit is 55. You at the other edge of town, you'd come to a point in which there'd be a sign that says now it's 65.
Governor, the president of the Union Oil Company last week said it was immoral and unconscionable for the state to try and maximize its revenues from Thailand's oil, and very critical of you and Duke Flournoy for trying to do that. Can you respond to that?
Well, actually, this is in the hands of the Land Commission and not the governor's office on this, but I can understand what he was saying and don't think that it wasn't a problem. They sit there, those who are in charge of this, and the price of oil has gone up. Now, the taxpayers of the state of California own a share of Tideland's oil, which they can take in cash or they can take in oil. Now, do they have a right to say to the taxpayers of California, we're going to continue taking this at the lower price when everyone else is now getting a higher price for them, or are they not beholden to the people enough that they have to get the best price for the state-owned oil that they can get? Those Tideland funds are used for a number of things involved in education and capital construction, and this was the problem they faced. What would have been the criticism if it had been learned that they were taking $2.50 a barrel and they could get $7?
Governor, statistics of the motor vehicles now have disclosed that there are more people moving out of California into Oregon and other neighboring states than are moving into California from these states. Do you have any comment?
No, I haven't seen those figures, but 7 years ago when I became governor, I said to all of our departments to start reviewing all of the plans, those departments that had plans for future growth, because it was my own belief that as a state reaches a certain size and becomes urbanized, as California has, that the things that were luring the great in-migration go away. That we had our great in-migration when we seemed to be a rural state with great opportunities and a new and growing state. But we are, I don't know whether anyone realizes this, California is one of the most urbanized states in the nation. We have our great stretches of open country, but the bulk of our population is living on 2% of the land. Three great metropolitan, or four, you might say, great metropolitan areas in the state. And what has been happening is this declining pattern. The general migration has always been toward the less developed state. What no surprise. I don't think we're going to lose growth. As a matter of fact, our figures all show that there's still going to be growth in California at our size from our own birth rate alone. But unless something very unusual happens, I think that California has passed through that stage of terrific in-migration. I'm cautious when I say that, because if you look at the history of California, it's been like a heartbeat. It's pulsed. We've had the great in-migration, then it levels off, then it starts all over again. And I'm as selfish as all the other Californians. I hope that a lot of people don't find out how wonderful it is to live in California. Well, I don't know just exactly what is happening in the state up there.
But do you think it's desirable to try and stem the out-migration from California? And if so, what can be done?
Well, I think you do your utmost to maintain a business climate in California that is conducive to providing jobs for our people. And you do your best to make, give California a high quality of life. And you might be interested to know that in a recent national study that was made based on where to live and based on quality of life, California came out number one in this, that the finest, the highest quality of living is to be found in the state of California of any 50 states.
One last question, if I may, on the Zebra case. Without getting into the guilt or innocence of the individuals under arrest, what's your reaction to this allegation of a statewide or nationwide conspiracy of this type?
Well, I just think that anything like this has to be explored and investigated, and that's why investigative procedures are going forward. You can't just ignore this. I don't care if it's where you hear it or what kind of a report it is that opens this subject up. It has to be looked at.
Very disturbing.
Well, I think the whole thing is disturbing. I think this and the guerrilla-type activity that now seems to have come to the United States, yes, it's disturbing. And after him, you got one more last one there.
On the transcripts, do they convince you now that John Dean lied to the water, the Senate Water Committee, from what you've read?
Well, Bill, I'd rather wait until I've had an opportunity to read more than just a few. We've only had those transcripts, or they've only been released 48 hours, and there isn't anyone in that committee or anyplace else that could read the 1,200 pages in this time that they've had them. I think that before we start making comments on this or anything of that kind, you have to see what's in all of them. And once again, as I said on behalf of the president, I'll say on behalf of John Dean, everyone has a right to be presumed innocent until he's proven guilty.
Sure.